Welcome everybody. Welcome to the quantum gravity seminar here at PI. Today we're very happy to have Markus Toell. I hope I pronounce your last name well. He's gonna tell us about invariant observables in quantum gravity, a graviton loop corrections to the Hubble rate, and the Newtonian potential. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the invitation. And well, that's what I've been talking about. It's sort of an overview of the work that I've done in the last, well, 5, 6 years. And if you have questions, please feel free to interrupt me as well. So I'm working in the setting of perturbative quantum gravity, which I will be telling you a bit about. And then I will tell you about, well, the biggest issue in there, which is the construction of gauge-invariant observables. That's not only an issue in perturbative quantum gravity, but in all series of quantum gravity. So I think this will be maybe the most interesting part to many of you. I will give some example on how to construct such observables if there is time. If not, I'll skip straightforward to the result section, which is corrections that in principle could be measured, Hubble rate and Newtonian potential. Let's start. What is perturbative gravity, quantum gravity? Well, you take your favorite gravitational action, Einstein-Hilbert in the most cases, some matter action, and you expand this perturbatively around a given fixed classical background. So that means for the metric, you take metric decomposition of a background metric, G0, and some perturbation H, and then you quantize H. The perturbation parameter in this setting is essentially the Planck length, which is, of course, well, a very small parameter, so it's supposed to be a very good perturbation theory. The theory has symmetries, as you also know. The symmetries are infinitesimal diffeomorphisms. So these are transformations of coordinates, x to x tilde, parameterized by some vector psi mu, which can depend on position. And this transformation leads to a gauge transformation of observables, of tensors in general, which is given by the Lie derivative with respect to that vector psi. And in particular, for our metric perturbation H, we recover the well-known result that its gauge variation is just a symmetrized derivative with respect to the background metric, plus some higher order terms. And then in the theory, you can use the usual methods of quantum field theory in curved space-time. It's a gauge theory, so maybe you want to use BRST. This is a well-defined theory. It's called perturbative quantum gravity, according to some effective field theory paradigm, because, I mean, as we all know, it's not perturbatively renormalizable, but it makes testable predictions at all scales which are sufficiently far removed from a fundamental scale, which in this case is the Planck length. And okay, there's a very nice review by Burgess from, well, almost 20 years ago now. It's extremely efficient, as I said, because the perturbation parameter is so small. And in fact, it's so good that experimentally we can only see the tree-level predictions, namely in the cosmic microwave background. But okay, we are theorists. I at least assume that most of the audience are theorists. So we want to go further than tree-level. And then the main issue is the construction of invariant observables. So I said before it's a gauge theory, but if you have a standard gauge theory, say of Young-Mills type, then the gauge symmetry is internal. That means it acts on the field variables at any given point. And then, for example, you can construct objects such as the trace of F squared, and that's a gauge invariant observable in the full theory. In quantum gravity or perturbative quantum gravity, this is not the case. In this case, the symmetry is external, namely, they are the infinitesimal diffeomorphisms, as I told you before, and they move the points around. So that means that if you take a field at a fixed point, it cannot be gauge invariant. So conclusion of this means there are no local observables in quantum gravity, with some small exceptions, of course. And what is the exception? Well, you take some tensor T, you expand it in perturbation theory. So there's a background value T0, there's a linear value, linear term T1, and then there are, of course, the higher orders. So if the background value vanishes, then in linear order, the Lie derivative or the change of the first order term under diffeomorphisms is given by the Lie derivative of the background tensor, and that is zero. So that means at linear order, we have a gauge invariant observable. But of course, if T1 is non-zero, then at higher orders, you will get a non-zero contribution. So it means that higher order things become gauge dependent. And in fact, it also works the other way around. And this is a classical result of differential geometry, Stewart-Walker lemma. If your variation at order k vanishes, then that means that at order k minus 1, you must have a linear combination of Kronecker deltas with constant coefficients, which of course can be zero. Yeah? But they must be constant in any case. And this is of course not very interesting because it doesn't include any dynamics. It's essentially saying it's a trivial case almost. Okay, so what can we do actually? Well, as I said before, the exception is linear order. So what you can do if you want to look at linear order is you take the expansion of any tensor that vanishes on the background. And a well-known example, you take as a background Minkowski space with a flat metric and the vanishing Riemann tensor. So that means that at first order, the linearized Riemann tensor is a gauge invariant. And this is a good exercise to give to a student because it's very easy to see it explicitly. You write down the expansion. It's this set of derivatives of the perturbation H. And then the gauge transformation of H, as we've seen on the first slide, is just a symmetrized derivative of our parameter xi. And then if you plug this in, you see that all the terms cancel pairwise. So it's really easy. It's a short computation to see that indeed at linear order, the Riemann tensor around Minkowski is a gauge invariant observable. Of course, Minkowski might not be the most interesting background, but this can be generalized. And in fact, through almost arbitrary backgrounds, what one has to use is a so-called ideal characterization. So this ideal characterization is an acronym. I forgot what it stands for. But what it is, it's a set of tensors which vanish if and only if the spacetime that you look at is locally isometric to reference spacetime. So going back to the example of Minkowski, the ideal set for Minkowski is the Riemann curvature tensor. Because it's known that if the Riemann curvature tensor vanishes, then you have locally Minkowski and the other way around. This can also be done for other backgrounds. So for example, for de Sitter or anti-de Sitter, then the ideal set is given by the Riemann tensor minus this combination of metrics for some constant, can be positive or negative, depending on your conventions. And of course, this tells you nothing else that the background, the de Sitter or anti-de Sitter spacetime is maximally symmetric. So that the Riemann tensor can be written as a linear combination of metrics with some constant coefficient in front. And then if you linearize this, this gives you gauge invariant observable at first order. So you get the linearized Riemann tensor. And then if you linearize the matrix, you get some perturbations H. And in fact, if you look at what this is nothing else but the first order expansion of the Riemann tensor with appropriately raised indices, and then the indices lowered with the background metric. And then one can again go back to this Stewart-Walker lemma. If you take the Riemann tensor with these set of indices, then on the background, it's just a constant times Kronecker deltas. So it's exactly as the lemma says. There are some more complicated background space times that one could look at. So for example, one could take Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker space time. So that's a conformally flat metric. There's some scale factor A, depending on conformal time eta. And this is a solution of Einstein's equation with an inflaton field as a matter source. Probably all know this, but I was told to keep it simple, so here it is. And the ideal set for this metric was computed in a paper, well, six and a half years ago, almost 7 years by now. It's a bit complicated, so I spare you the details, but if one takes this ideal set and then linearizes it, one obtains observables at linear order. So one of those is the Weyl tensor, linearized Weyl tensor. And that's of course not surprising because the background metric is conformally flat. So that means that the background Weyl tensor vanishes, and then again, Stewart-Walker tells you that the linearized tensor is an observable. The same goes for a tensor which I call E mu nu. So you take the Einstein equation, including the stress tensor of that inflaton field, and you linearize it around the background, and then you get a tensor which also is a gauge invariant observable at linear order. And there is one other tensor which is a bit complicated, and as you can see, it took almost a year to find this last tensor. And this is something that is constructed from an extrinsic curvatures of the constant phi hypersurfaces. and the relation between the Hubble rate and the potential of the inflaton that you put in. And then other context, this ideal construction has also been used for black holes. So there's a more recent paper here on the bottom. And one advantage is that it gives you a complete set of local observables. So you know that at linear order, if you do this linearization of such an ideal construction, you get a complete set. So every other observable can be, local observable, can be expressed using derivatives of this set. And I see a
Marcus?
Question. Yes.
There is a question.
Yes,
for
please.
You by Lomar.
Yeah. Just about this last point, which I find quite remarkable, Marcus. So you're saying there is an ideal for a black hole? You mean Schwarzschild or Schwarzschild care or? It sounds pretty impressive.
So if I remember this correctly, this was Schwarzschild.
Okay. Wow, okay.
And I think they are trying now to generalize this to Kerr, but it's, of course, very difficult.
Okay. Well, already that's kind of very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, so one thing they found in that paper was that the observables that people have been studying before, that set was incomplete. So there was one more observable that they
okay.
found with this construction.
Nice. And it has been used to do new things in perturbation theory for black holes?
This I don't know. This,
okay.
But one would have to look it up. Okay. Of course, linear order is nice, but if you want to go to higher orders, then things become difficult. And in particular, as I said before, if the tensor at first order, so the linearization, is not trivial, then at second order, it's not gauge invariant. So that means that beyond this exception of linear order, there are no local observables in GR, which is, of course well known, but it's also easy to see in this way. And then one has to think about other observables. Of course, people have been thinking about this for a long time. I'm not claiming there's anything new here. So there are straightforward things, for example, averages over the whole manifold. So then if you look at diffeomorphisms which are localized in a certain region, then these don't change the value of such manifold averages. But of course, that only gives you a number, so it's maybe not very interesting. Something more interesting are correlation functions at fixed geodesic distance, for example, and then averaged over the whole manifold again. So you insert in the integral some delta function, and that also gives you a non-local observable. I mean, it's very clearly non-local. Another very well-known non-local observable is, of course, the S-matrix, whenever it exists, or flat space, or in, say, ADS scattering amplitudes. For the sitter or cosmology, that's not so easy. But, of course, if you go to the lab, we make local measurements, including gravity. And then the question is that arises, how this can be reconciled with the non-locality of observables. And the answer is, well, these are two different kinds of non-locality or locality. And what we actually do in the lab is we make relational measurements. And of course, again, it's nothing new. It's known since a long time. But I think it took up speed in the last decade, maybe. So what we measure is the state of one field with respect to some other field. We don't look at things at a fixed point on our background, but we see how two dynamical fields evolve in relation one to each other. And then, okay, so this is the idea. I mean, if you think about it, it's obvious. Question is, how can you put this to work? How can you construct some object that makes this relational measurement that incorporates that? And okay, let me tell you how it works in practice. You take four dynamical scalar fields, which serve as a dynamical reference frame, or as it's also called configuration dependent coordinates. How to choose them, I will tell you later. And then the invariant gauge invariant observables, relational observables, they are dynamical fields evaluated in this reference frame, in this system of coordinates. So in formulas, four fields x mu, index mu is in parentheses because they are not vectors. That's a collection of four scalar fields. Can depend on the metric, on any meta fields, whatever you have in your theory. And then in perturbation theory, okay, have to transform as a scalar. There should be scalar fields. And in perturbation theory, they have some background value. How do you construct your observable? You expand this background value, linear order, go to higher orders. You invert that relation. Then you obtain a functional, so the background value as a functional of the full dynamical coordinate. In perturbation theory, that's easy to do. And of course, if X transforms as a scalar, then this inversion transforms inversely to a scalar. So that means that if you evaluate some field A at that position x0, holding the dynamical x fixed, that gives you the invariant observable. So for the interpretation, this A of what I call chi here, so that's the value of A, provided that my dynamical reference frame, my dynamical coordinate system, has the value chi. And then evaluating it on the background value x0, that means that we interpret this object as a field on the background, and then we can do computations. So if you like to work, maybe not as explicitly, but in a more abstract differential geometry way, then A is just a composition with the invariant A. It's the composition of A with x inverse is x0. And in this way, it's also easy to see that it doesn't change under diffeomorphisms, because both the A and the X change in such a way that their changes compensate. Okay, so so far for the general theory, how does one construct these scalar fields, this coordinate system? What people did in the beginning, and this is, goes back an even longer time, is to choose, for example, some curvature scalars, like Riemann tensor squared, Ricci tensor squared, or to add some additional scalar fields. So there's a very famous Braun-Kuchasch dust, which is also used a lot in loop quantum gravity, as I understand. But these choices have problems in perturbation theory. Or not only in perturbation theory, but at least in perturbation theory. Namely, if you look at a highly symmetric background where you can actually do computations like Minkowski or de Sitter or even Friedmann, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker, then the background is, as I said, highly symmetric. And then the curvature scalars, they do not discriminate points. So in Minkowski, all points are the same, all curvature scalars are zero. So this is not a good choice of coordinates. If you add additional scalar fields, then of course you change the physical content of your theory. So this is maybe something that you do not want to do. I mean, this is shown very explicitly in this nice paper here. So, okay. In cosmology, we have one scalar field, so the inflatron, so it's not as bad, but we need four. So then the question is, how can one construct these scalars without adding them by hand? And okay, I've written down here the FLW background, including the Friedmann equations, because I will use these later, but I think you're all very familiar with them. So a solution to this problem of construction of dynamic coordinates in perturbation theory in such a highly symmetric background, this was, as far as I know, first solved by these people here in 2016. And they said, well, so the time coordinate is very easy. We have our background solution, phi zero of eta, so the inflatron field depending on the time. We can invert that relation, that's supposed to be a one-to-one relation, and then just define our invariant time by taking this relation and plugging in the full dynamical inflatron field. So we take eta of phi instead of eta of phi zero of the background. And then what you get if you expand this in perturbation theory is, of course, on the background, it's just eta. And that first order depends on the first order perturbation of the inflatron, normalized with the background value. And this is nothing else but the time of co-moving observers. So it's something, well, very physical, used a lot in cosmology. And for the spatial coordinates, they had the idea, which in retrospect is, again, simple, but no one, as far as I know, had that idea before. They said, well, on my background, on my FLRW background, the spatial coordinates, they are harmonic. So they fulfill Laplacian xi equals zero. So what we do, we just define our dynamical coordinates, xi, spatial dynamic coordinates, as harmonic coordinates for the full Laplacian operator on the constant inflatron hypersurface. So on this hypersurface, where the x0 time coordinate is a constant. And yeah, as far as I know, this is this was the first complete solution in cosmology and perturbative quantum gravity. And it has the advantage that it can be computed to arbitrary orders. I mean, there were some proposals maybe at first and second order, but this is really something that one can do at arbitrary orders in perturbation theory. And moreover, it gives some very nice results. So if you now look at observables that you can construct using these coordinates, of course, one important stuff would be invariant metric perturbation. So what you do is you take your metric, you transform it into that dynamical coordinate system. So this gives you a Jacobian determinant and small x, so that's the background coordinate, depending as a function on full dynamical coordinate, and you subject your background metric and hold the dynamical coordinate x fixed. And then to first order, what this gives you is just, well, I've written it down here, the formula. So it's essentially metric perturbation minus a term which depends on the first order expansion of your time coordinate and the derivatives of the first order expansion of your spatial coordinates, of your harmonical dynamical harmonic coordinates. This is what I wanted to say. And then if you check how gate transformations work and how these coordinates transform, these terms, these added terms exactly cancel as they should, the gate transformation of HMU. And again, this is, as I said, this is not something very strange or totally arbitrary, because you recover well-known things that people have been studying in cosmology for ages. For example, the time-time component of this invariant metric perturbation at first order on shell is just given by the rescaled derivative of the Mukhanov-Sasaki variable. So one really recovers things that people have been working with. But now it's possible to generalize these to all orders, you know, second order, third order, however, how much you want. One can also get the Badin variables. For those, one has to choose a slightly different time coordinate. The details are on the paper. I don't want to bother you with that. And of course, since, so in the construction, as you can see here, for example, you always have to invert Laplacians. So you get some non-local things, as it must be. But there's an additional drawback, because you have to invert a Laplacian, so the non-locality is also non-causal. And you have things that influence your observable from points which are space-like related to it. This is something which you could call action at a distance, it's something that you don't want. And moreover, this leads to problems with renormalizability. So this is not something nice. The solution is also very simple. Instead of a Laplacian, use the Dalembertian. And then you don't need to invert, you don't get the Green's function of Laplacian, but you get a Green's function of the Dalembertian when you invert it. And then if you choose the retarded propagator, then you get something which is explicitly causal. So that means that the non-locality that is always there, as we have seen, is restricted to the past light cone. Yeah. So this is something which one could call causal generalized harmonic coordinates, which are in this paper here. For actual computations, one can then do some further simplifications. Of course, the observables are gauge invariant. That is how they were constructed. So one can use a gauge in which these first order corrections vanish, and then this computation simplifies a lot. And in fact, the propagator of the metric perturbations in such a gauge, or if you want the propagator of the invariant metric perturbation, one can even write down in a general Friedmann-Lemaître Robertson-Walker spacetime in terms of just three scalar propagators, which fulfill simple equations that depend on the scale factor. And of course, those then must be solved for each background separately. But the whole tensor structure very nicely reduces. And so this is something that is very amenable to computations. It's not just something abstract. Okay, I think this was it almost. So of course, one can generalize this to flat space. There is something which is known as geodesic light cone coordinates, but I think I won't have time to go into that. Synchronous coordinates, so I put here some references. If you're interested, just have a look or write me an email. And as I said before, the invariant observables one gets in this way are always non-local, but they are causal. So the non-locality is in the past light cone of the point where they are evaluated. Time is it? It's 9. So I think I will skip this section and come directly to the results, actual results, because there's physics in that. So first thing my collaborators and I looked at was the local Hubble rate. What is the local Hubble rate? Well, you take your inflaton field phi, you compute its normalized gradient, so that gives you a four velocity, which tells you in which direction the inflaton evolves, and then you take the divergence of that. So the and this is what is usually called the local Hubble rate. So what this tells you is how fast the flow lines of the inflaton diverge, yeah, or go apart. So this is a measure for the expansion of your space-time. And of course, one can check that this agrees on the background with the usual three-point definition a prime over a squared on shell. The invariant observable is determined as before. So we use these causal generalized harmonic coordinates. And I've given you here the first order expression, so the first order correction to the background rate. You see that it depends on the inflaton perturbation on phi 1 and on the metric perturbation h0 and hk. You might wonder, well, this is a local expression. I told you before that things are non-local. This again is a lucky accident at first order. It's because in the background, h is only time dependent and the invariant time coordinate is locally the inflaton. This is the reason why you get something local for the Hubble rate at first order. But if you write down the second order expression and higher expressions, then they are non-local. Of course, as I said before, so the time coordinate is nothing else but the co-moving time of co-moving observers. The interpretation of the spatial coordinates is less clear. I mean, you could say, okay, the harmonic coordinates, but what does this mean in practice? If you have an idea, please let me know. And then we just use the usual QFT methods to compute the expectation value. So you put some gauge fixing term, some ghost terms. For practical reasons, what I did was to look at constant slow roll parameter epsilon. So that means, or constant deceleration parameter. And I mean, it's nice on one hand because it simplifies the computations. It's nice on the other hand because you can also treat matter-dominated universes and radiation-dominated universe, so almost the whole early history of the universe. So one thing that is new in this case is that you need additional counterterms to define your invariant Hubble rate as a composite operator. Yeah, so I mean, of course, you have the usual counterterms that you need for a cosmological constant, some R-squared terms that you need to renormalize. But if you look at, okay, the first order expression is, of course, linear in the perturbation, but the second order expression is quadratic. So this is a composite operator. And for this, you need additional counterterms. At one loop level, it's not too difficult, because essentially you always get h cubed to the background. And then you do the computation. It's a bit long, but can be done. What are the results? So the first thing to look at is the De Sitter limit. So that means zero epsilon, yeah, constant h. So exponential expansion. And what I found is that there's no correction at one loop order. So, okay, might be surprising, but it's at least consistent with some other computations. So there are some other well-known people who work in perturbative quantum gravity who looked at different but related observable for the Hubble rate, and they also find no correction at one loop. And okay, that's so it's consistent with their result. For other cases, it's much more interesting. So first thing is that what I can also treat is meta domination. And then what you see is that at one loop order, so there's it's a very tiny effect. It's multiplied by the Planck length squared times h squared. So the prefactor is, of course, very small. But it depends on the logarithm of the scale factor. So that means that, universe expands, A grows, the logarithm also grows. That means that the Hubble rate, the effective Hubble rate that the observer can see, is screened by quantum effects. And this is what is known as a secular effect, because it continues to grow with time. How does it work physically? Well, if your universe expands, we know an expanding space jam creates particles, and in this case, it creates gravitons. Of course, these gravitons interact, and gravity is universally attractive. So, of course, these created gravitons, if they attract, they slow down the expansion. And this is exactly what you see in this result here. You get a diminishing effect, and the effect becomes stronger the more time passes. Sorry. In the second case, so for radiation domination, again, there is no one-loop correction. And at first sight, it's again surprising, but it's also consistent, and it's consistent with the physical picture, because in a radiation-dominated universe, it has been shown before my time that there is no graviton production. So this physical mechanism cannot start, and the computation shows, this is exactly what happens. No graviton is produced, so they cannot interact, so they cannot screen the Hubble rate. And then lastly, so I looked, or me and my collaborator, we looked at slow roll inflation, so epsilon much smaller than one. And then what one finds is that one gets, again, a slow roll expansion, but with a slightly corrected slow roll parameter. So in fact, the resulting space-time is a bit closer to the sitter space than the background is. And there are some very similar results if you allow for non-constant epsilon. So if you take epsilon prime, that's basically, well, that's proportional to the second slow roll parameter delta, different from zero, but very small, you get expressions which look very similar, except for the numerical factors. Of course, one problem is that these effects, well, at least for the moment, are much too small to measure. As I told you, it's a very effective perturbation theory. But maybe if one could do these computations to, say, higher orders, higher loop orders, one would get terms here which grow, say, with logarithm squared, logarithm cubed, and so on. And then resumming all those, it might be possible to get an effect that would actually have some observable signatures. Of course, it's a difficult computation, so it will still take some time. But this is something that we are planning to do in the future. Okay. So then, for the second result, the loop corrections to the Newtonian potential. So this is something else that people have been looked at. Let's start again with the physical picture. What do we have? We have some virtual gravitons fluctuating around. They polarize the vacuum, and this vacuum polarization changes the gravitational potential of a point mass. So the system that, what do we need to study? We need gravity, we need a point mass, and we need to compute our invariant observables to get some gauge invariant physical effect. So in classical gravity, the Newtonian potential is just given by minus one half the time-time component of the metric. So what we do to compute corrections is we take our invariant metric perturbation, h mu nu, and we define the Newtonian gravitational potential by minus one half its expectation value and then the time-time component. So this is, it's very different from the scattering approach that people have been using to compute corrections to the Newtonian potential, but it's much closer to what one would do in classical gravity. And as I will show you in the end, we recover the result from the scattering approaches. So I think this is actually a better way to do. Anyway, as coordinates, what did we take? Well, as before, these generalized harmonic coordinates, because they are the easiest to work with. And then, you know, just for your perusal, I've written down how such a first order correction to the coordinates actually looks like. So you see, again, it's a non-local. So it's an integral over a Green's function times a linear combination of metric perturbations. And this Green's function is now, since our background is flat space, a Green's function of the flat D'Alembertian. And of course, we'll take it as a retarded one to ensure a causal evolution. Gravitational action is Einstein-Hilbert action expanded to second order. And of course, if we want to look at the potential of a point mass, we also need the point particle action. So this is, of course, it's also well known how this action looks like. For computational purposes, it's very nice to use this form with an Einbein. There's also the other form with a square root, but this is ugly to work with. So this action apart from the metric, it depends on the particle's position z, and that itself depends on the affine parameter tau. So z of tau is the world line of that point particle whose gravitational potential we want to compute. And of course, it has some mass. Then in addition to the diffeomorphism symmetries, there's also a reparametrization invariance of this action, which is just a change of the affine parameter under which well, things transform in this way. That of course makes the actual computations a bit more difficult, but still can be done. So one has to extend this BRST formalism to include these reparametrizations, and then one gets a lot of diagrams. And there's one more physical input that one has to make or has to use. Namely, what we're interested in is the change in the gravitational potential due to loops of gravitons. So what we're not interested in are fluctuations of the particle itself. So what we're doing is we make it just very heavy. So that means that we take a particle on a straight line on the background. So it's just some four velocity times tau. And then the fluctuations are suppressed by some power of the mass or inverse power of the mass. Sorry. And the same goes for the Einbein. And then if one does the computation, one sees that there are four types of diagrams at one loop order. So they are the usual graviton and ghost loop diagrams. And these can be computed as usual. The only new thing is that now on one side they couple to the point particle, and on the other side is the point where we want to look at, where we observe our potential. There are world line corrections, so one where these fluctuations y mu circulate in the loop, so these diagrams of this sort. There are some classical corrections, of course, that we also see. And at the very last, there are some corrections from the field-dependent coordinates. So, as I said, we use some very nice gauge in which the first-order corrections to the coordinates vanish. So what we have are only the second-order coordinates, denoted here by these double wiggly lines. And so these are these three diagrams. In general, there are much more. So there are also these diagrams, but in the gauge that we are using, they are all zero. So it simplifies the computation a lot. What we get is we get a classical correction. So this is the result here, so the spatial part of your metric and then the time-time component. And this agrees with the expansion of the Schwarzschild metric in harmonic coordinates, as it should. So, as I told you on the first slide, what we're using are generalized harmonic coordinates. So of course, it's no wonder, and a good check on the computation, in fact, that we recover the expansion of the Schwarzschild metric, which is the metric of a point particle, in harmonic coordinates. And then we get quantum corrections, so two types, in fact. So this is the potential here, V of R, classical minus GM over R, the classical Newtonian potential. This is the classical correction. And then there's this correction here, 41 over 10 pi times H bar d Newton over R squared. Of course, for dimensional reasons, that's the only term that can actually appear there. So it must be Planck length squared over R squared. The only non-trivial thing is the coefficient. And this 41 over 10 pi is that coefficient that agrees with the inverse scattering method. So this is the one that people after computing for 10 years found using a lot of Feynman diagrams and S-matrix formulas. And this term here comes from the normal graviton and ghost loops. So this is exactly the same as before, which is of course very reassuring. The second one is negative, but a bit smaller. And so you see this 43 over 12 pi. This one comes from the second type of diagrams, so from the world line fluctuations here and the world line fluctuations here. So even though we tried to suppress the fluctuations of the particle, we made it very heavy, there is still a remnant of these fluctuations in the theory. It's impossible to suppress them completely, and it gives a contribution to the potential. And of course, I mean, if you studied quantum field theory, for fermions, there's something known as a Zitterbewegung. And if you want, this is sort of the gravitational Zitterbewegung. Okay, let me make a nice picture. Of course, it's vastly exaggerated, the scale. But you see, so the quantum corrections, what they do they dip the potential down close to the particle a bit into the negative. So that means that the gravitational force at small distances from the particle is strengthened. Yeah, the potential is more negative. Or if you want to interpret these corrections as corrections to a black hole, which people have done also as well, then you see this potential, the corrected potential, passes zero a bit closer to the body. So that means that the quantum corrections decrease the black hole horizon radius. So instead of the Schwarzschild radius, we get Schwarzschild minus something. And you can check that this is actually positive, so it's a decrease. Okay. Let's.
Hi, can you hear? Sorry, so you said that that's positive, so it decreases the horizon.
Yes.
Okay, so I was wondering, do you know what the repercussions for gravitational waves would be? Is that like even farther suppressed, and therefore there would be no evidence in any coalescence diagram? Or?
So, I mean, I don't know the exact repercussions, but the problem is that these corrections are tiny, extremely tiny. So you see, I mean, it's easier to see from here. They are of order h bar g, which, yeah, and there's some c to the 4, which here is equal to 1. So this is essentially Planck length squared over r squared.
Yeah.
So these are really corrections of order of the Planck length. So experimentally, that's totally invisible.
Totally invisible. Even in the moment in which two black holes coalesce into one, in the very, very last, where we have least control indeed on the experimental data, you would expect this to be completely invisible, right?
Completely invisible, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Unfortunately, this is, of course, it would be very nice, but.
thank you very much.
No, I mean, maybe this has some influence on some primordial black hole models. This is possible, you know, black holes of Planck size or a few Planck sizes. But for any macroscopic black hole, this is completely invisible.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so let's come to conclusions and outlook. I was quick. Well, not too bad. So I am working in perturbative quantum gravity, and the difference to just say quantum field theory in curved space-time is this issue of gauge event observable. So this is the main difference. On the other hand, this is also a connection to, say, fundamental theories of quantum gravity, like loop quantum gravity or other approaches. We have seen that the observables can be constructed, but they are non-local. Definitely, there's no way around that. Non-locality can be restricted to the past light cone, so they can be causal, and one can construct them to all orders and actually do computations with them. And the result that I've shown you were this secular screening of the Hubble rate. So this is something that could, if this effect persists at higher loops, be measured in the CMB. So this is one possibility, maybe the unique possibility. We've also seen that gravitational force is strengthened at small distances, but this for any macroscopic object is, yeah, unfortunately totally invisible. And if you're interested in this topic, so together with my collaborator Igor Hafkin, I'm writing a review paper which should come out sometime this year. What is left? What is missing? So some outlook. Well, I've done also some work on the de Sitter background. Yeah, what I've shown you for the Newtonian potential was just Minkowski. So one can also compute corrections to Newtonian potential due to matter loops on a de Sitter background. And then, okay, what is the result? It looks quite similar to the flat space one. So you get the correction, which is essentially the de Sitter version of the flat space correction. And as I've told you, it's Planck length squared over r squared. Now r is not the coordinate r, but the physical r. So it's a distance on some equal time hypersurface. But there's a second correction now that we have a non-trivial de Sitter background. So you see there's a constant correction here. So with, again, there's a prefactor, of course, Planck length squared, h squared, which is very small. This constant correction depends on the theory. So we looked at conformal matter fields and depends on the conformal charges and on the coupling constant of some r squared term in the action. But there's also a second term, and this second term is actually very interesting. Because as you can see, it grows with R. I mean, only logarithmically, okay. And there still is prefactor Planck length squared, but it grows with the distance. So that means that comparing with the flat space picture, so going back to my slide, in the sitter, you would actually have corrections also at large distances. Yeah? So the curve would go maybe slightly above. And now this is something that potentially, I mean, depending on the size of the coefficients, could have an effect on, say, large-scale galaxy, of movement or evolution of galaxies on a very large scale. Of course, this is a one-loop effect, so one has to compute this at higher orders. And this is a correction due to matter loops, not to gravitons. So something that I want to do in the future is compute also graviton loop corrections using this invariant observables. And if you look, okay, something that also did, one cannot look not only at the Newtonian potential, but also at the gravitomagnetic potential. So that's the zero I part of the metric perturbation. It looks all very similar, but it's a nice perturbation. And then I don't know if there is probably no one of the asymptotic safety program here in the audience. So there's a very nice, very recent paper looking at RG flows and gravity in this program in the Lorentzian setting, so not in the Euclidean setting, which most of these people work in. So I'm also planning on generalizing this construction in that setting. Okay, I think that's it from my side. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Markus, for the nice talk. Questions? Yes, there's a question here in the room, Mark.
Hi, Markus. Thank you very much for the nice talk. I have a question regarding the two-body potential, the Newtonian potential. And you had these two contributions. Did I understand correctly that you said that the Donahue computations only get the term with the plus sign, while you get an additional term with this minus sign? Or did I misunderstand that?
No, that's correct, yes. So what Donahue and others find, I mean, okay, you know, they look at these scattering elements of scalar particles, so not point particles, scalar particles, and they find this term.
So of course, so what have they been missing compared to what you have been doing to get this additional negative contribution? Because it seems that they would overestimate the quantum gravitational contribution, right?
Yes.
By an order of magnitude.
Yes. So. I mean, what I've been computing here, as I said, is the expectation value of the time-time component of the metric perturbation. So analogous to the classical computation of the Newtonian potential in GR. What they are doing is they look at the S matrix element, and then they say, in the Born approximation, which classical potential would give the same S matrix element? So it's not even physically clear to me that this is the same thing. Of course, it's reassuring that you know, the diagrams, so the usual graviton ghost loop diagrams, also on this approach give the same factor. But since we look at, you know, a real point particle and compute its potential, we also have these other diagrams. So this one and these loops. And those are the ones that give that factor. So this is what they are missing. But as I said, I'm not even sure that this is the same physical object that they are looking at.
I see. And can I ask a second question?
So
just out of curiosity, so how technically feasible would a two-loop calculation be? Like, is it possible, or is it like completely away from?
it's possible, I think. So the main problem is that, I mean, especially if you have some computer algebra program, which of course we also use. So the main problem is that you have these other type of diagrams. So these are propagators of this y mu fluctuation, which only depend on the parameter tau and the affine parameter. So the integrals that result are not of the standard Feynman type, you know, that can be done by programs, specialized programs. I forgot the name now, but there are some which you probably have used as well for some computations. So, I mean, we know how to do it. It just gets a lot of indices. It gets long. But I think it's feasible.
So you're saying that the difficulty is more the integration rather than the tensorial complexity of the computation?
So the tensorial complexity, you plug this stuff into exact, let it run for a day maybe, and then you're done.
Okay.
So this is for a year. So I mean, in fact, so this was a project of a master's student. So you see, one loop is very feasible.
Okay.
And I think the notebooks that he wrote, they need maybe an hour or so to run for the tensorial stuff. So I would expect that at two loops you need maybe a day, but I don't think that's a big problem.
That's okay. Thank you.
All right. There is a question online, Simone. If you want to unmute yourself.
Yes. Thank you. I just wanted to better understand how you're interpreting these corrections, because in the Donohue results you cite, there is a lot of discussion about the classical ambiguities in this Newton potential. And so what you are saying is that, so I could define the Newton potential by looking at some component of the metric in some class of coordinates. So this would be a completely coordinate-dependent statement, but now you're saying you give a physical meaning to these coordinates by attributing them to some special backgrounds, and then because you're doing the calculation of linear ordering perturbation theory, you can identify quantities which are invariant. Is this the logic, or how coordinate-dependent statement of a certain component of the metric has a physical meaning being turned?
I understand the question, yes. It's almost. So, first of all, it's not linear order, it's actually second order. So it's one loop order. So what I'm saying is that one needs to take into account the physical coordinate system in which the results are measured. And then, of course, it's nothing else than making this very explicit, if you want.
And you use the background to characterize that.
And the construction of these depends on the background. So
you use the background to identify some coordinates that can be endowed with a physical meaning. And then you say, I'm doing the calculation in those coordinates, which are invariantly characterized because thanks to the background, I know what physically they mean.
Absolutely. Okay. That's the idea. So here what we did was use these generalized harmonic coordinates. And then you can say, well, harmonic, so that means the coordinate lines are as straight as possible. Second derivative is zero. So in some sense, we're straightening things out. That would be the interpretation. How to realize that in a lab? Well, that's, of course, a different thing.
No, actually, now it brings me another question, because I remember discussing issues like this in our group in Marseille. I guess when you say harmonic coordinates, this is just characterized in a unique way, right? Or it's a family of coordinates, just one set of coordinates that you pick.
It's just one set of coordinates, yes. So this is for Minkowski background in Cartesian coordinates, and then extended in perturbation theory to all orders.
Right. So I think the very naive question that we had was that, on the other hand, when you do the quantum calculation, I suppose you just take the Donder gauge.
In this case, at first order, yes, but there are some second order corrections. So there are these diagrams.
As you know, that the Donder gauge is not a complete gauge fixing. So I'm always confused. So the calculation, you do it in the Euclidean, I suppose.
Nope. This is fully Lorentzian. So in this case,
okay,
there is one more.
How do you know?
I just want to say, so there's one more ingredient, which is this, how to invert this D'Alembertian. And this fixes the coordinates completely. So one has to choose the Green's function of the flat space D'Alembertian, which enters here. So we are saying what we want is we want the causal evolution of our system, so we take the retarded propagator. So this fixes everything completely.
No, I understand that you pick the retarded propagator, but when you say that it's in the Donder gauge, that is not yet fixing it.
I mean,
you could be transfer traceless, it could be anything else. I mean, classically. So my confusion is that I understand that classically you want to pick one coordinate system, but when you do the calculation with the perturbative quantum theory, mm-hmm. usually you don't need to pick one, you just say it's the donder. And I thought that the reason for that was that because you're doing the calculation in the Euclidean and not in the Lorentzian, but you're saying no, that's not the point.
No, so how is the H mu is completely gauge invariant. You can, so the choice of coordinates is completely decoupled from the choice of gauge. This,
but I mean, but then you compute the graviton propagator for little h, not for big h.
Yeah, yeah, sure. You can use any gauge Feynman gauge.
To do that, you need to.
You don't need to use the donder. You could use Feynman gauge. You would get the same result.
And Feynman gauge is unique, unlike the donder?
Yes, Feynman gauge would be unique, yes. So in Feynman gauge, the propagator is just the submatrix times the scalar propagator.
Okay,
scalar propagator.
Good. So now it's unique. And now then my question would be, so is this choice of Feynman gauge now corresponding in some sense to the unique choice of harmonic coordinates you made?
No, the computation is completely independent of the gauge.
I see. Okay.
You could use Feynman gauge, you could use some Landau gauge, some de Donder gauge, whatever you want, it doesn't matter. You get the same result. So the input you have is this fixing of the coordinates. So we get extra diagrams where these coordinates enter, so which are these ones here in the bottom line. And this one make the whole result gauge invariant. So you can really pick any gauge for little h that you want. And you would get the same result.
Okay, are there other questions for Marcus? Well, then on this nice gauge independent note, I propose we thank Marcus again.